Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, here with John Wells. This morning we start off with a fascinating discussion of how our modern and complex systems, those we depend on daily, can and do fail. From train derailments to massive oil spills, co-writer Andras Tilchik joins us to discuss his book, Meltdown, Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It.
Good morning, Lynn. I'm John Wells. And then Park City's own Jeff Atkinson of Huckabye. Huckabye is an SEO, or search engine optimization company, based right here on Main Street in Park City. Why did this young entrepreneur base here? And why does he consider Park City a growing industry for technology? We will find out.
And finally, we speak with scientist and mountaineer John Ahl about his book, Icefall, Adventures at the Wild Edges of Our Dangerous, Changing Planet. In his work as an environmental scientist, John explores the effect of climate change in places most of us never go, and that's above 20,000 feet, blending science with adventure and all that goes along with research at that high altitude on many different continents. This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words.
Quarterly Summit Community Power Works reports During This Green Earth is brought to you in part by Rocky Mountain Power. Being energy efficient is good for you and the Wasatch Back. Being mindful of how you use energy makes our community better. More information on how to make a difference at wattsmart.com.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, here with John Wells. Well, from train derailments and massive oil spills to bankruptcies and medical errors, system failures are all too common. And our next guest, Andras Tilchik, says they're becoming more frequent. What's going on here, and how are these breakdowns of our modern, complex systems related? Tilchik is the co-author of a fascinating new book called Meltdown: Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, first off, maybe a good way and really very current in my mind is the seeming proliferation of train derailments, but also all kinds of accidents, failure to have a governor on speed, creating accidents. And maybe we could just start with that. I mean, talk about that complex system and why it fails.
Yeah, so you're completely right in that I think we see these kinds of failures more and more, these sort of surprising failures where there isn't necessarily a big external shock that brings down the system. It's more that small failures and just ordinary human missteps come together and kind of snowball into something much bigger, right? So train derailments, it's a great example. They don't happen because there was an earthquake or because there was a terrorist attack. There's something about the system that just sort of became so complex, confused the operators, they are doing the wrong thing, and that can lead to these massive failures. Or take airlines. In the past, 5 or 6 years, we have just seen so many of these cases where entire airlines had to ground their fleets because of a small misstep, because there was a glitch in their reservation system, or somebody, as it happened in the case of British Airways, unplugged the power cord. And then the next thing you know is tens of thousands of people are stranded and thousands of flights are canceled. And we see this pattern more and more, and I don't think this is something we have seen 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, when our systems were a little less complex, a little less connected, and they were a little more forgiving.
Right. And what you talk about is, you say that it used to be that the only really complex systems were things like space shuttles and nuclear power plants. And now everything, you know, including the thermostat in my house, is connected in a big complex system. And what you're saying is sometimes, or like, we haven't caught up with building in room for these failures. And the failures, like you say, could be something as little as a human error, you know, unplugging the power cord.
Yes, that's precisely it, right? So we are living in this different world where we are surrounded by these complex connected systems. We often invite them into our homes. We have smart homes. We have these connected cars, which give us a lot of new capabilities, but they also tend to set us up for these sort of surprising failures that are really hard to predict. And once they are happening, they are really hard to stop. Once the genie is out of the bottle, it's hard to put it back. And as you mentioned, we see this in small systems like our homes and cars and kitchens. We see it in these sort of grander systems as well. If you think about finance and trading, 20 or 30 years ago, people were trading in the stock market. And you know, if a mistake was made or there was a misunderstanding, people could call back a trade. They could clear up a misunderstanding. If your client is calling in this really large order, you could double check. Now it's computers, and everything is much faster, much more connected. And as a result, we started to see, even in that sphere, some of these really crazy failures that just emerged. One firm that we studied as we were researching the book, it's called Knight Capital. A couple of years ago, it's a large, a very well-respected Wall Street firm, at the time one of the largest traders on Wall Street, and they lost about $500 million in just half an hour. And that's a lot of money, even for Wall Street, and especially in such a short time period. And that's something that would never have happened 20 or 30 years ago.
And as the systems are getting more complex, some of these things we have to go back to are a good old-fashioned basic business decisions. And you tell a great story about Target in the book, about their desire to expand into Canada with 130 new stores, and how the business decisions really weren't very solid and how much it cost them. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, I think that's a great example that actually fits very well into this pattern that we've just been talking about, where small things end up snowballing into a big failure. So Target, when they decided to come to Canada, they thought about some risks, but they were these sort of big issues of, you know, can we recruit enough qualified employees? Are we getting the right kind of real estate? How are we going to run our marketing operations? But in the end, what really brought them down was these small things like French language characters in their inventory management system or in their software that they weren't used to using, or data that their associates incorrectly entered about the dimensions of products. And as a result, what we ended up seeing was, we have this very complex system. They also made it very unforgiving in the sense that they wanted to do this very, very quickly. They were very ambitious. They didn't do it gradually, they just wanted to open 120 or so stores within a year. And so that meant there was a lot of complexity, which brought up these surprising problems, but there was also not a lot of margin for error. And I don't know if they could have really reduced the complexity, but I think if they had given themselves a little more time, a little more slack, they might have had a better chance of dealing with those emergent problems that were sort of so hard to foresee.
Yeah, and unfortunately, our business schools today are still teaching some real basic concepts. You know, there's your costs, there's your sales, there's your this, and they're not looking at the complexity. Maybe they were looking at this through a lens which was relatively old-fashioned.
I think that's exactly right. I think that to us really seems to be the issue, that we are still operating as if we were running these large business organizations or small ones or any kind of complex system as if we were in, say, the early 1980s. And I think you're completely right about sort of what is it that we teach students and future managers about this. And we teach them about costs and profits and sales and revenues and that kind of stuff. And once we realized that complexity and the lack of slack, this sort of unforgiving nature of the systems, is something that we can think about explicitly, and something that these are dimensions that tell us which parts of our systems are most vulnerable. We could actually use those as pretty standard variables in decision making in business. And we actually saw a couple of examples where that was done. But I think in the mainstream business world, this is still not happening. But I think we're going to see more and more failures, and at some point, it's going to force that change.
A couple of months ago, a friend of mine was in Hawaii, and luckily, he went for a long swim, and he missed the whole ballistic missile warning. But his family was in the hotel, and they were calling home, saying goodbye to their loved ones, and, you know, a missile's incoming. And it was, you know, obviously it was horrific if you talk to anyone who went through it. I believe it was human error that gave the warning, but the reason that they couldn't recall it for like 30 minutes was that they hadn't built in that system for allowing for human error. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, and I think that's a great point, and really a horrific example, but it's a great example for understanding how this happens. And In the 1970s and 80s, we have seen those kinds of failures in things like nuclear power plants and space shuttles, where we design a system and it's so complex that it ends up confusing people, and they press the wrong button, or they misread a graph, or there's a small failure and they don't know how to deal with it. They want to do something about it, but they are doing the wrong thing. They are solving for the wrong problem. And our temptation and our inclination for a long time was to blame people and pin it on the operators. But, you know, in many ways that's really just hindsight. And these are, of course, errors, but they are sort of errors in hindsight. And we created a system that made it very easy for that person in Hawaii to press the wrong button and create this huge havoc, and with really no ability to bring things back. So I think that's actually one of the key takeaways from our research, is that often blaming the operators is really a cheap shot.
Right. Yeah. If you're just joining us, our guest is András Tilcsik. He has co-written a book called Meltdown, Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. I think of that back to this space shuttle disaster in the 1980s, and there was one scientist who knew that the rings at a certain temperature would fail, and he gave warning, but his warning was not listened to, was not observed, and there was no action taken. And this is something that you talk about as well in your book, is that we need to listen to the little guy who may be, you know, just giving some suggestions about what could go wrong. This is part of what we need to do.
Yes, one of the hallmarks of these complex systems is just that there isn't one person who has all the information and has all the knowledge and can make all the shots and make the right predictions. The information is really distributed, and sometimes it's the little guy, and often it's the little guy who's sort of lower down in the hierarchy, but they are closer to the ground. They might have a concern. They might not be able to explain what exactly it is, but just something doesn't feel right to them. And sometimes they have evidence that something is not working, and we often don't listen to them. You brought up Challenger, which I think is a fascinating example. In that there was a scientist who brought this up. There was actually a lawyer who was at NASA, was also concerned about this. So somebody who was a true outsider to the decision making, but just from their conversations with engineers, they were onto something, but the organization didn't listen. And I think what's really striking about the Challenger case is that in some sense it repeated itself about, I think it was 17 years later, in 2003, in the form of the Columbia space shuttle disaster, which technologically on the surface is a very, very different kind of failure, but the organizational and management aspects of of it, the lead up to it, and the kinds of conversations that people were having and not having are eerily similar. So it seems like we end up making the same kinds of mistakes over and over again.
A while back, I was with a technology firm, and we had a product that had a number of real-time mission-critical applications. One was for the launching of spook satellites for the CIA. One of the other applications was a trading floor environment. And what I was fascinated by, it was microkernel-based, and what that means is it was a very small subset of a regular operating system. Microsoft Windows is 14 million lines of code. There's over 2,000 commands. There are so many things that can go wrong in Microsoft Windows. You don't want to have a mission-critical application hanging on that type of operating system. You're almost asking for trouble, aren't you?
Yes, but the hard thing about this, of course, is that, you know, sometimes there's no other way, or at least we haven't come up with a simpler, cleaner, more transparent way of doing these things. And often we add complexity because we are building a new capability, right? So going back to the trading floor, right? Electronic trading and computers on Wall Street have given us all these new capabilities, and in some ways it's a much more sophisticated and effective and capable market structure. But on the other hand, there's all this complexity that comes with it, and we just don't think about that. We think about the upsides of the capabilities, but we often forget about the complexity and the risks it brings in. And I think you see the same kind of thing in people's homes or in people's cars. We want connected cars because they give us all these new shiny fancy things. Like my car's display tells me where I can find cheap gas or where there's a good restaurant nearby wherever I'm driving. And that's sort of a nice, convenient feature. But at the same time, there is now all this research done by technologists and hackers which shows that those connected cars can be hacked. And once you are in the system once you have a foothold in that system, you can really actually take over the entire car, which is a really, really kind of scary conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. I'm still trying to figure out how a guy back in the 1400s, this guy Occam, or I think he was from Occam's razor, how he could come up with something which is so profound today that if you're looking at a couple of possible solutions, the simpler solution is always probably, or the simpler answer is always probably the best way to go. Maybe if companies would think about Occam's razor or think about some of these complexities, how do we get that in front of business leaders today so that they can consider that more often as they work on their projects?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's the goal, and it's hard in that one of the things that really surprised us as we were working on this book is that a lot of the solutions that smart companies and families and organizations have come up with to these kinds of problems are actually pretty simple, but that doesn't mean that they are easy. Often they go against our natural instinct, right? It's sort of the nurse who speaks up about a mistake that she doesn't need to tell anybody about. That just seems like an exceptional case. That's not what we want to do. And when we see these small warning signs, we want to ignore them. And when somebody's raising a concern and raising a dissenting voice to us, it's really hard to listen to that. It really sort of goes against our very deep human instinct. So I think you're totally right in that the key challenge is really implementation and getting people to change their minds. And that's really what motivated us to write this book, to show people that these things are within our reach, but we do need to do things differently because it's not 1982 or 3 or 4 anymore.
It seems in some of the conversations that we've had on this show, talking to people who deal with algorithms every day and artificial intelligence, things like that, that there hasn't been a human element built into those things. But now big tech companies are hiring social scientists, anthropologists, to be able to, as you say in the book, you know, maybe foresee some of the human error or be able to anticipate all of the mistakes that could happen. And I'm wondering if in your research you found this same thing, that we got to a point where we trusted technology too much and now we're backing off of it.
We have seen a lot of cases like that, really ranging from, I don't know, car design to flying an airplane, that we really come to rely on these systems so much, or going back to the home, right? If we have the smart thermostats and the smart smoke detectors, and they are great on a normal day, and they make life so much easier and so much more convenient. But when they are hacked or when they fail, everything else fails with it too, and we're really not thinking about those days, about those sort of crisis days. And you mentioned AI, which I think is very interesting in that, you know, one of the potential benefits of AI that people talk about is that it will make it easier for us to predict how things might play out. It will be a sort of prediction machine that will lower the cost of prediction. On the other hand, it's a lot of these AI and machine learning applications are really like a black box, and I think you're completely right that makes human judgment a lot more valuable. Even though our instinct is usually, oh, this thing failed, let's just add more technology, let's just add one more layer. Even though what we find is that it's often those additional layers that create the complexity where these small failures can blossom into something much bigger.
Yeah, well, it's pretty fascinating. You know, just you give so many examples in the book of really these amazing things that happen. And we are reminded of, it was just a couple of weeks ago that there was a fatal accident involving an autonomous, was it an Uber, I think, in Arizona?
Yeah.
And I wonder what what's your response to that sort of thing? I mean, you're developing such a link between, you know, the DNA of the complexity of these systems. And do you find yourself calling up companies and you know, giving them some recommendation?
Or waiting for them to call? And I think, you know, you mentioned autonomous vehicles. It's really a good example of this, in that they are going to give us, ultimately, they are going to give us all these great capabilities, and certainly on an individual basis, they will almost certainly be safer than an individual driver. They are not going to be, they won't be drunk driving, hopefully. They won't be texting, or if they are texting, it doesn't distract them. They are not going to do all the silly little human mistakes that many of us make while we are driving and our attention doesn't work quite as well. But at the same time, it will be a very complex system, and how that interacts with human drivers and other autonomous vehicles and other systems, that is a concern. And if I look at some of the companies that are working on these technologies, such as Uber, they don't often strike me as the most open-minded and most strategic in terms of thinking about complexity and the risks and all these broader social implications that might come into play.
Right. András Tilcsik is our guest. His book is Meltdown, Why Our Systems Fail and What We Can Do About It. And I have to tell you, András, John and I are sort of playing tug of war. We only have one copy of the book, and so we're fighting over it. It's very interesting. Thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Thanks for having me.
And stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters with Jeff Atkinson of Huckabye.
Hi, this is Steve Roney, owner of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. I'm a proud resident of Park City and a loyal supporter of KPCW and all it does for our community. Our agents in Summit and Wasatch counties can be reached at any of our 30 offices or at our website, bhhsutah.com.
Hi, I'm Julie Hopkins at Keller Williams Real Estate. I share KPCW's pride in our community, and so I love supporting the Daily Lost and Found Report on KPCW and their coverage of Park City's fantastic nonprofits. For real estate, it's jhparkcity.com, and for Lost and Found, it's KPCW every day.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Do you have gently used furniture, appliances, cabinets, or building materials that need a new home? Donate them to the Habitat Restore and help local hardworking families. You can bring your items to us or schedule a pickup at 435-658-1400. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Andras Tilchik, his book Meltdown. Now joining us in the studio, Jeff Atkinson. He's the founder and CEO of Huckabye. Huckabye is a tech company based right here in Old Town Park City. It takes a new approach to SEO, or search engine optimization. And from his years at Overstock.com, Jeff knew how difficult it was to get high placement when customers searched an item they were looking to purchase. As we know, without placement, you've got next to nothing. So how do search engines really work, and what did Jeff put into his company that's helping businesses gain up to 85% better placement on searches? He joins us now to give an update on Huckabye. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So give us an update on your company.
Yeah. It's been 10 months since we last spoke, and I'm proud to say it's been an incredible 10 months. I think we've grown something like 3x since we last spoke. The business has reached a point of real stability and sort of hyper growth at the same time. So it's somewhat organized chaos where we're trying to hire as fast as possible. And what's really exciting in my mind is to see how well our clients are doing today versus the last time we spoke. I think we talked last time about aligning ourselves with search engines and that we were sort of skating to where the puck was going, and that turns out to be true. In fact, our clients are doing much better today than they were 10 months ago, which is exciting.
And one of the tenets of this is make your client's website understandable to Google, and to the extent that you can do a better job at that, you'll be able to generate better searches. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, exactly. Websites are always built for human beings. We spend so much money and so much time and energy on what they call UI, UX, which is user interaction, user experience. And I argue—
Lots of acronyms in this business.
There are. And I argue in any given day, the most important visitor is actually this little search bot that comes in from Google, and their experience is not nearly as clean and crisp and understandable as it is for a human. So we really do translate your website so that a search engine can understand it as well as a human being can.
So tell us how a search engine, how it actually works. Because, you know, if you go on different search engines and you look up the same item, say, you'll get different placement from, you know, different companies. So talk about that a little. I don't understand it at all. I know it has to do with algorithms and programming and all that, but do you have a simple way to explain it?
Yeah. I think the simplest way to explain it is how Google became number one, because they're really the way that search engines operate now. So it used to be that they just understood websites through coming in and crawling HTML. That turns out not to be the best way to understand. They started taking links into account. So links come to websites, and there's something in that link. So if you hover over a link, there's a certain amount of text that gets underlined. That text is called anchor text. And Google figured out that those words in that link meant more than the actual HTML on the page. So they understood that the anchor text was very important. And then they also understood that not every site is equal. So a small blog about iPads is a lot different than Apple's site on iPads. And so they figured out it's sort of what they call domain authority, which is how important a site is. And that's also based on links. So the New York Times, for example, is different than the Park Record. But that's because the New York Times has millions and millions of links. Links are like votes, but not every vote's equal. So A link from the New York Times is also different than a link from the Park Record. So there's there's really the content, then there's the link, the anchor text. It's a real science, but to give you a quick synopsis, that's sort of how it works.
That's great. Now
structured data, of course, which is what we do.
That's right. So I'm just thinking of one of the businesses that you've helped, and let's go with the local, well, sort of local, local component of their business, POC. So when you take in a new client, what do you find are the biggest mistakes? There probably are just some glaring mistakes or some immediate things that you can help them with. And maybe I'm asking this question for our listeners that are saying, I'm wondering how I can get better placement a little easier with this free advice from Jeff.
Happy to give it. Yeah, so for Huckabye, the first piece that we do is install our software, which basically starts translating a site like POX to a search engine so that a search engine understands it much more clearly than they did before. As soon as that happens, results really start to improve. After that, there's, you know, we have a few pieces of software, but after that, we also do have a customer success team that'll look at a site like that and give them recommendations. A great example for POC is they call what they used to call, anyways, any kind of eyewear, they would call eyes. And no one searches for eyes. They search for sunglasses or goggles. So you can always see this. Whenever you look at any website, the very first thing I look at is how descriptive is their navigation. So if their navigation is not descriptive and it says eyes and it says wheels is what they used to call bike, that's not going to align with what a search engine is looking for. They're very confused. They'll think they're actually searching for eyeballs or something like that. So that's a really quick win that we can do with a client like that is change their navigation to be more descriptive. So a search engine comes in, they finally understand kind of what's going on. There's a bunch of things like that, but that's one of them that's very important.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jeff Atkinson. He's the founder and the CEO of Huckabye. Last time you were here last May, we were talking about content is king. And there are a number of websites out there that need to have content to make their podcast or their blog or whatever they're trying to sell more attractive to the outside world. Talk about what you provide to your customers for content.
Yeah. So we have a content curation tool called Huck News. Content is king. It's a little less important, the volume of content. So it used to be that you had to write and write and write for content to really matter. So that's why blogs became so crucial for SEO. Now, search engines really want to see the site evolving. There's so much different types of content and content that they don't understand that they still have to give that new content credit because users really care about it. So content like video, content like social media, like they really want to see things evolving. So with Huck News, the idea was, say for POC, for example, they have a category page and it's filled with products. And those products, you know, come and go. But for a very important page like polarized sunglasses, there's really nothing changing of significance for a search engine. And so our tool is basically allows them to leverage external pieces of content, write a short blurb on why they're posting it to their polarized sunglasses page. So it could be an athlete wearing an Instagram post of the athlete wearing the sunglasses. You know, someone on their team writes quick, you know, check out this athlete wearing our sunglasses, post it to the page. Now that page is changing in a meaningful way and it took 5 minutes. So I'm a big fan of content integrated on pages that really matter to the client and pages that sell and generate revenue. And Huck News is just a really efficient way to do that. So typical type of content that'll be used in Huck News is Instagram is actually the number one used piece of content. Next would be YouTube and then sort of news articles and so forth. So it's just a way to be able to have an excuse almost to add content to your site in a really efficient manner without having to, you know, sit down in a studio and record something, put a camera up and start videoing. There's so much great content out there. Leverage it and then, you know, make it unique by adding that comment and then boom, you've got a really nice fresh piece of content.
You may be representing other manufacturers' products and they may have gone to great lengths to put together a video or something that really shines a light on that product. So, I mean, that would be a perfect example.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, companies spend millions of dollars on their Instagram feeds and they just sit on an island. They might get some benefit from it and in terms of branding and so forth, and you know, a trickle of sales. But let's leverage that piece of content and make it work for you on your core site.
So you're busy. You've tripled the size of your company in the last 10 months. But no doubt in Park City, you're pretty involved in the world of technology. And you are up at, well, are you still up at the Rockwell Room? Or
yep,
did
we're
you
kind
outside?
Of bursting at the seams, but we're still there, which is a nice thing.
And so no doubt you're talking with a lot of other people in the tech world. And, you know, what do you see happening here in Park City? I mean, we know in the Valley and the Silicon Slopes. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of tech going on, but what do you see here and how do you see that growth happening?
Yeah, I see a lot of tech leadership here. And by that, I mean a lot of executives, a lot of founders. So there's a lot of leadership. One thing that I have noticed between the last time we spoke and now is that it is the talent pool is hard. The economy is so strong. Salt Lake, and from the sort of the Silicon Slopes from Provo to Salt Lake, is booming, and finding really good tech talent here in Park City is hard. I think it would, you know, that should be an effort for our local economy, is making, you know, qualified tech talent move here, because it is a wonderful place to live. I think it is starting to serve as a bit of a disadvantage for us to be here and having to have people commute from Salt Lake. So I think, you know, so it is less affordable, but that's something I've noticed. A lot of leadership, so a lot of ideas, a lot of, you know, founders and executives. But for that sort of mid-layer and up, it's hard to get them to actually live here full-time and, you know, realize that this is the place to be.
How many of your employees live here?
I'd say about half. About half live here and half live in Salt Lake.
Jeff Atkinson, founder and CEO of Huckabye. Great to see you again. We're going to keep our eye on you, that's for sure.
Thank you, John. Yeah. Thank you, Lynn. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
We shall return right after these messages. And when we do return, we're going to be speaking with John Aull. He has written Icefall: Adventures at the Wild Edge of Our Dangerous Changing Planet. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Stephanie, store manager at Jan's, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Jan's carries skis from brands like Atomic, Fisher, and Kessley, plus custom boot fitting to ensure boot comfort on the slopes. We also offer rentals of snowshoes, snowboards, and clothing. Jan's Mountain Outfitters, 649-4949 or jans.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Jeff Atkinson of Huckabye. Now we turn to the highest reaches of planet Earth and a scientist who ventures to the highest peaks in the world to collect scientific data on our changing world. Dr. John Aull is a research professor of environmental sciences at Western Washington University. He's also the director of the Mountain Environments Research Institute at Western Washington and the executive director of the American Climber Science Program. He's a geoscientist whose life has been devoted to exploration around the world as he examines how climate change and resource management interact to impact communities and the biosphere in mountainous regions. He joins us now to discuss his new book, Icefall: Adventures at the Wild Edges of Our Dangerous Changing World. Welcome to Cool Science, John Aull.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, great to have you. You know, it's pretty easy to find you if you just do a Google search, and what comes up first is your YouTube video that I think sort of went viral after you fell down a 70-foot crevasse in the Himalayas, and you had the wits about you somehow. So bizarre how you had your wits about you when you were so injured, but you turned on a recording device and sort of recorded your unbelievable crawl out of that crevasse. And it was all in the name of science.
Yes, ma'am. It was a tough experience. But being a scientist, I typically take pictures everywhere I go in order to record data. And in this particular case, when I had fallen down there, it's very easy to panic. And one of the things you want to do is find ways to kind of calm yourself. And so in this case, turning on the camera and then talking to myself, talking through my situation. I can't climb that way. I can't climb this way. All my bones are broken. Calmed me and allowed me to really make a plan in order to get out of that crevasse. So it's funny how science can interact to help you in an emergency sometimes.
Yeah, and this happened, I just think days or very soon after a horrific accident on in the base camp area, I believe, of Everest. And it's the title of your book, Icefall. Can you talk a little bit about what that mission was and then what happened?
Well, yes, ma'am. We work on the high mountains of the world. And snow is like if you leave a coffee cup out, you know how it gets filled with dust over time as it comes into the air. Well, snow does the same thing. It absorbs and collects dust that blows around the earth. And so by climbing mountains and sampling the snow on those mountains, we can look and see what's moving around the planet in terms of things like black carbon or if there's a mine nearby, maybe lead or arsenic or some of these other things. And it lets us know a lot about air pollution, about forest fires and other things. And so that's what my work is climbing mountains and sampling the snow on them to find these things. And so we were on Mount Everest, and because it's kind of the perfect place to look. It's very high in the atmosphere, so most of what's happening there is long-distance transport. And it's between China and India. And so you can look at how two of the major population centers, two of the bulk of humanity live and compare how they affect the air on either side. And so we were there to collect these samples. And unfortunately, climate change has made the mountains very dangerous. And ice is collapsing more and more frequently because as it gets thinner. And in this case, it hit our team and several other teams and killed many local Sherpas, including part of our team. And so that accident weakened our team, and so we ended up moving to another part of the Himalaya to continue our work. And that was when I fell into the crevasse.
Boy. When people talk about the new climate, they oftentimes talk about, you know, that there's more energy in the atmosphere and the storms are going to be more difficult. They're going to be stronger. Droughts will be tougher. Tornadoes, hurricanes, all those sorts of things. And rightly so, they should talk about that. And also the rising of our oceans and those sorts of things. But people don't talk as much about some of the small things, and you cite in your book about the CDC in Atlanta, the Center for Disease Control, and for an example, the resurgence of malaria because mosquitoes can now fly to more states, and states where mosquitoes were never a problem, they can now bring malaria or West Nile or Zika. You also talk about ticks expanding into more territories and having longer seasons, and Rocky Mountain spotted fever, valley fever in Arizona. Have we been surprised by the empirical data that has shown up in the last 10 years? Is this expansion greater than was originally expected?
I think it's greater because what's the best way to put it? Our society is not built to deal with it. The way we've addressed malaria, for example, in the past is most of our capital cities or our big cities in places like Africa and Central America are at higher elevation, and they're at higher elevation to avoid the mosquitoes. You don't build your city down in the jungle. You build it up on the 3,000 or 4,000 foot in elevation.
And that way you don't have to worry about mosquitoes. And so when mosquitoes move up and suddenly they're in Mexico City or in Quito or some of these other in Nigeria, there's no way to deal with it. There's no kind of societal response. You can't spray everyone. And so things like malaria tents that are treated with insecticide to sleep in, there's small things you can do, but just societally we've built around a certain type of planet. And when that planet changes underneath us, we're not prepared to address it. And so that's one of the reasons I've worked all over the world, is tried to look and see, first of all, how those changes are occurring, but then more importantly, how are societies addressing it? Because we can't, you know, you can't move Mexico City. It is where it is. And so how have societies now and really in the past addressed these changes and these threats?
So in these tropical areas, they had these cooler highlands, higher elevation, and they were really a refuge up until recently, because the new climate, these things are starting to move their way up. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Well, and they're moving their way up in elevation in the tropical regions, and they're moving their way up in latitude. And so cities in the U.S., for example, in North Texas or even further north, that used to be on the very edge of malaria or encephalitis or some of these other mosquito-borne diseases, now the range in the mosquitoes is moving well up into the United States. And so cities that didn't used to be at risk, like Atlanta, say, now it's more of a question. Are these species of mosquitoes able to move into these areas? And somewhere like Florida, that was always potentially at risk and has had in the past outbreaks, is even more concern, even greater concern. So California, Texas, Florida, some of our largest population states, have these very valid concerns about what that's going to mean for disease in the future.
Mm. I find it so interesting that you have married these two things that you love so much and have made a really great career out of it. I'm kind of envious, I think. So you love the mountains and you love science, and you do both. And until I got your book, I had no idea that there was an American Climber science program. But take us to the Andes, to the Cordillera Blanca, and mountains like Huascarán that you climbed and collected samples from, which it's just so interesting to picture you collecting samples of snow in these bags and then hiking down with them. Sounds kind of like a heavy endeavor. yeah, and just the sense of the good that you're doing and the important research that you're doing in these areas.
Well, and I'll take that a step further. I think the research is important, but also the education we do. And that's why I initially co-founded the American Climber Science Program, to work with citizens and to help people who were concerned about the mountains get out there and help us carry these heavy loads of snow in beautiful locations. But what I found was you're reaching a few people at a time. Like you said, you've never heard of it. We're occasionally an outside magazine or something, but it's a limited access. But if you really want to change the world, it's through education. And so that's why I founded the Mountain Environments Research Institute here at Western Washington. And the reason we work in Peru is I take students from Western Washington, really from around the country, UCLA, University of Colorado, and other students will join our expedition. But we go to Peru because it's kind of like the Himalayas light. In the Himalayas, you've got to trek for 2 weeks to get to your mountain base camp, and then it takes you weeks and weeks to climb something, and we get amazing data there. But in Peru, we can go with people who are learning, and it takes us a day to get to base camp, and it takes us a day to go and collect the samples. And the samples are just as valuable because the Andes have a very similar climate, global climate effect as the Himalayas. You know, they're right in the middle of global wind patterns, and they act as a wall. And again, you get the same things deposited on them. So I kind of get the best of both worlds. You can collect really great data, and I can also work with concerned citizens as well as students who are interested in learning more about how to do science out in the wilds of the world. And so the great thing about the Andes also is we can study a lot of different things as we move into the mountains. And so we can look at water quality. We can look at how grazing affects vegetation, and so how that affects the local people. Because at the end of the day, esoteric research for itself is interesting, but we want to do research that actually makes a difference for both global science as well as for the local people who live in these areas.
Right.
We always try and work with local schools. Like we've brought in solar panels to help light up schools. We work with trying to predict fire behavior and trying to predict water flow rates and how retreating glaciers will affect the availability of water in the future. And so, again, things that will make a meaningful difference in the lives of the local people. So I love the Andes because they allow us to do that. They allow us to educate. They allow us to make a difference with conservation and get some incredible research.
Right. And I think from the coast to the highest peaks in the Andes is, you know, between 90 and 100 miles, which is just amazing. As you say, you can get where you need to go within a day instead of weeks. That's just fascinating.
Well, and it's beautiful because when you have sunsets from the tops of those peaks, like we're in a base camp at 6,000 meters, so 20,000 feet, we'll be in camp, and you can look out and you can see the sunset over the Pacific Ocean. So it lights it up like any Pacific sunset you've ever seen, but you're on the side of a mountain, so it's incredibly beautiful.
And we're speaking with John Aull. He has written Icefall, Adventures of the Wild Edges of Our Dangerous Changing Planet. You know, as I was reading your book, you're really out in the wild most of the time. You very rarely have a pickup truck next to you, or although you do have a pickup truck, but it's, you know, I mean, I can't do the math, but I would say probably less than 0.1% of the time that pickup truck was by your side. And and you're a very lucky person because you had this pack of hyenas that attacked you. And your pickup truck was right there. I mean, you had to maybe run 50 or 60 yards, but your pickup truck was close enough that you could dive into this thing as it was ripping off your shoe. Can you talk about wrestling with hyenas?
Well, it's funny. You started talking about pickup trucks. I'm like, I never have a pickup truck except in Africa. And Africa is just a different place to work because we sort of laughingly say everything wants to kill you. The plants have thorns and poisons in them. The animals are all looking for their next meal. There's not a lot of water. There's disease. It is one of the most difficult places on Earth to live. And it's a real testament to the people who have survived there for thousands of years that they've managed to develop coping mechanisms to deal with all these issues because it's a very harsh landscape. And especially with the wild animals, story after story of people being killed as they're trying to do research, or game wardens being killed by the very animals they're protecting. And it's a difficult lifestyle. In the case of the hyenas, we, again, always had that pickup truck close by, but we thought, well, we found a nice protected area. We can sleep here for the night, continue collecting our data in the morning, because we typically go from dawn till dusk, collecting data when we're in the field. It's so expensive and so difficult to get to these areas that you want to be sure you collect everything you can. So we, went to sleep, and about a couple hours into the night, I hear a hoof beat, but it was a hoof beat with a padded foot. I thought, well, a horse with a padded foot? And slowly as you wake up, your mind goes, wait, that sounds like a predator. And so we shine our flashlight.